Good morning. I'm Scott Fuller. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family group. My home group is the Early Risers group. We meet on Saturday morning in Birmingham at 8 o'clock, and I'm always there unless I'm doing something with Bo, like today. I want to thank Dirk and the rest of the board for asking me to speak. I really love this roundup. It's one of my favorite ones. We do a lot of different. We go a lot of different places in this particular endeavor, shall I say? And it's one of the most my favorite times. It's some of the best food I've had on the road, so to speak. And the fellowship is wonderful. It really is. Let's see. I was reminded of a comment somebody once made in listening to Dirk's introduction. I found myself at a meeting in Birmingham once, and it was like the end of the month, and it was supposed to be the end of the month. It was supposed to be a speaker meeting, and the lady who was running the meeting was a little upset or a little nervous because the speaker had not shown up. In fact, as it came to find out, nobody had signed up or gotten a speaker. And so she asked me if I would be willing to do that, and I said, certainly, no problem. I'd be glad to tell my story. And as she was introducing me, she said one of the things that really struck her about my recovery was my commitment to service, which I had to laugh because, in truth, if it weren't for Al-Anon, I would just be committed. So I'm extremely grateful for this fellowship, for this program, because above all else, it's given me many, many things in the last 12 years, but or 13 at this point. But the main thing that it has given me is a relationship with the God of my understanding. And for that, I will always, always be grateful. I start at the beginning. Al-Anon and I are about the same age, literally. I turned 65 this year, and back in 1951, in May of 1951, Lois and her friend Ann B. got a list from the AA Central Office of family groups that were interested in AA's program, and they wrote a letter to see if these groups would be interested in coming together to form a fellowship, much like Alcoholics Anonymous. And they received, I think of the 87, they received 50 back. But they mailed those letters in May of 1951, which is the month I was born and the year. So unfortunately, it took me 53 years to find you guys. But as I've heard it said many times, it happens when it's supposed to happen, and that's what happened for me. I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. My parents are from the Midwest, but very early on, we came to Birmingham. My dad got a job as a manufacturer's representative, and he was given for the company he worked for, the Southeast Territory, and he came down here to this area back when cars didn't have air conditioners and there were no interstates, and he was given a choice of one of three places to settle: Atlanta, Nashville, or Birmingham. And in 1951, my dad decided on Birmingham. And as it turns out, it really was a great place to grow up. It hasn't thrived and grown at the rate of Atlanta and Nashville, but from my perspective now, that's okay. We had a very, during that time, I thought we had a fairly normal family. I don't know how many of you remember Leave It to Beaver, but I always thought we were kind of like the Cleavers, very much. I mean, mom always had dinner on the table, dad would come home, he would have one drink, that was it, one martini, And that was, you know, I have a, and there were three children. The only thing about my childhood that really relates to what got me to the doors of Al-Anon, I think, was in growing up, my siblings and myself were all interested in the arts. And people would say, well, you have such a talented family. You're an artist and a musician, and your sister's a dancer, and your brother's an actor. And I said, well, it stands to reason, because my mother's a critic. Every compliment had a but at the end of it. Every one. And it wasn't until I got involved in recovery that I became familiar with the word perfectionist, and that's pretty much what my mother was. I grew up in the 60s. She wanted me to look like one of these nicely coiffed young men in a cardigan sweater on the cover or on the pages of one of her fashion magazines that she got millions of. I had no intention of doing that. I wanted to have long hair. I played drums in a high school rock band, and it was a teenage years were a bone of contention, what can I say? But I think most teenagers have problems with their parents. I decided, though, to go into art and majored in art in college, went as far as to get a master's degree. And one of the interesting things, a great thing about this program is it gives you, or it certainly gave me, the ability to go back and look at aspects of my life and realize why I made some of the choices I made. Because today I don't make art. I thought that's what I was going to do. Wasn't it at all? One of the things I've come to realize in my recovery is that it wasn't so much the passion to make art that was so important to me. I was pretty good at it, and it was the feedback or the adulation I got from people. It made me feel better than I felt about myself, obviously. And if you don't, one of the things I've come to realize in any art form, I've seen this in friends and, you know, in myself, in the fact that I don't pursue that, that is that I don't have a passion for it. And if you don't have a passion for what you do, it's pretty hard to sustain it. My passion was to find people, places, and things that made me feel complete. And I pursued that like crazy. It led me into a lot of different directions as I was growing up. Some of them probably were not some of the wisest choices I could have made, but then again, that's the way they worked out. In 1981, now, like I said, I played music. I love music. And I spent a lot of time in bars growing up, going out to listen to music, and became involved with the local blues society in Birmingham, which worked out great for me because they met in bars. And in a bar one night, I met my wife in 1981. She was already there. And I came in, and she used a line that's probably not used very often. She came up and asked me, said that I looked like somebody she knew from her past. I was not that person, but it didn't really matter. When she tells her story, she says I was pretty easy, which doesn't surprise me at all. On our first real date, I remember her telling me that she had no intention of getting married and no intention of having children. And I thought, yes, this is going to be great. Because I really wasn't, I was interested in finding, you know, a soulmate, but I really wasn't, the idea of marriage and the idea of having children was really not on my radar at all. Well, that was 81. By 84, we were married, and by 83, we were married, and 84, we had our first daughter, our only daughter. We had a daughter, and we, like so many, I mean, you know, we had our struggles for the next 20 years. I can't say that I, you know, when I first started learning about Al-Anon, I really struggled a lot with it because I would read these pamphlets. One of them I remember in particular was the, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it was the Merry-Go-Round of Denial. And in that talks about going around and looking for your spouse in bars or pouring out drinks or finding hidden bottles. I didn't do any of that. But to give you an idea as to really how sick I was, at the time I got this thing, I said, well, some of this applies, but there's so much of it that doesn't. So I went out and I bought a whole pack of colored highlighters. And I took one color and I marked every line in there that related to my wife. And I took another color and I marked every line that related to me. Then I took a third color and I marked every line that didn't have anything to do with either one of us, which proved absolutely nothing other than I was a pretty sick puppy at that point. And we had our struggles in the years leading up to 2004. I did a lot of things to, I spent a lot of money I didn't have. I did a lot of things I really didn't want to do, but the thought of not making somebody happy was just really more than I could handle. And so in 2004, my wife came to me. She was a nurse, and I wound up going into the graphic arts. I worked for a number of years for the newspaper while I was going through school and eventually left the news and went into business ultimately for myself. She came to me and she said that her mother was going to have to come live with us. She was in Birmingham, and her mother was developing dementia. She had neuropathy in her legs. She couldn't walk very well. And a number of years before, in 2001, my mother had been diagnosed with colon cancer. And Jan, being a nurse, when my mother was diagnosed, they said, we've discovered cancer in your colon and it's moved to your abdomen. And we've gotten you an appointment with the oncologist, but he can't see you for 3 weeks. My wife wouldn't hear anything of that. She was determined that my mother was going to get the best care possible. So the next day, she had set my mother up with the head of oncology at UAB and had scheduled a colonoscopy because she knew from her training that the first thing the oncologist was going to require was going to be a colonoscopy. Well, that procedure uncovered a tumor, which my mother had operated on the very next day. If we had waited for the 3 weeks for her to see the doctor that they had made an appointment with, she wouldn't have been alive. So Jan was really responsible for giving my mother 2 or 3 extra months of really good life. And so when she came to me and said, we really have to do something with Mother, she's going to have to come live with us, I felt like, well, I had to say yes. I didn't want her to come live with us, but I mean, a house is fairly good size, but it really wasn't. We had just sent our daughter off to college, and I was kind of enjoying being an empty nester, and that was getting ready to change. I really had no idea how big a change that was going to be. We took one of the bedrooms, painted it bright sunny yellow, put up new curtains, got a new sheet comforter for the bed and everything. My mother-in-law moved in and took over the entire house. There were lamps moved. We had two little dogs at the time, and my wife and I both worked away from the home at that point. So we would come home and there would be dog treats all over the house. Even the dogs got tired of eating dog treats. And, you know, there would be the dining room table always had a puzzle on it. And it escalated. Well, to be honest, that summer of 2004, she came to live with us in March, and things, our drinking became more, increased more and more. Now, let's see. It was the end of September in 2004, and this is part of my wife's story, but I'll tell it since I've got a part in it. We spent a lot of time happy hour at bars, because this is, here again, this is how chaotic our household was. We discovered when my mother-in-law came to live with us that she had a drinking problem. And so our solution was to take all of, because she had difficulty with stairs, we took all of the liquor and put it in the basement. So we spent the summer of 2004 drinking in the basement. So she couldn't get down the stairs to it. And we spent a lot of time meeting after work for happy hour. And one evening, we met at one of our favorite haunts, and she had a couple, when she ordered a glass of wine, they knew what she wanted, and it was a big goblet. She had a couple of those, and then she went up the hill, not far from the bar, to the church where we were attending, and she facilitated I don't know if it was a Bible study, some kind of group meeting, and then it was an Episcopal church, so of course after all these little meetings, the leaders got together and drank wine with the priest to talk about what had happened. The last thing she says she remembered was being helped to the car. Now, I had left the bar to go home and give my mother-in-law something to eat. And after a couple hours, I went down to the basement to get a beer out of the downstairs refrigerator. And I could see, the way our house is set up, I could see out the garage doors, and I could see my wife's car. The lights were on, but it was in its space, and I thought, well, she just pulled up. So I went back upstairs, and I sat there, and I thought, that's kind of weird. So I finally got up and walked outside, and she was passed out at the wheel. The car was in its place, it was kind of cocked a little bit. The lights were on, and the motor was off, but the lights were still on, and she was passed out. And I said, you know, I had never seen her do this before. I mean, I had seen evidences of some of her behavior changing. Like, there were times during that period, if we were driving or we were sitting somewhere having something to eat and I felt a hand come up and start rubbing the back of my neck, I knew I had 30 minutes to get her home, or her face was going to be in the whatever it was she was having for dinner or whatever. She began, unbeknownst to me, drinking more and more down in the basement. So I got her upstairs into the house. We had to navigate some stairs, and she sort of fell back on me and wrenched her knee. She woke up the next morning, and she sat up in bed, and she says, I've got a problem. I've got to do something about my drinking. Now, or at least that's what I heard. So we took her to the doctor and to get her knee looked at. And later that day, she called me and she said, "I've got to talk to you about something." And I came to find out that afternoon that she had been to see her. When she told her doctor that she thought she had a problem with alcohol, that set into motion a whole chain of events that we weren't really ready for. I mean, I had a pretty good idea at that time what an alcoholic was, and I didn't think of my wife as an alcoholic. I mean, as I said, I was involved with a group of people that liked to hang out in bars, and there was always this guy who was around, kind of a peripheral, and it didn't matter whether you saw him at 11 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock at night. His eyes were bloodshot. His speech was slurry. Yeah, that was, to me, if you say, do you have a definition? That was an alcoholic. You know, he was constantly drinking. My wife, on the other hand, was not like that. So the idea of me, I remember the first time I ever heard her state in an open meeting, I'm Jan Fuller and I'm an alcoholic. It shocked me. I mean, I just never had wrapped my head around that idea. But she told me that she had gone, her doctor had sent her to talk to somebody at UAB, and before the meeting was over, she said, well, I've got to go back to work. And he said, no, you're not. You have a choice. And you either report yourself to the Board of Nursing or I will. And you really don't want me to if you want to keep your license. So in October 4th of 2004, Jan went into treatment. And as I have said many times, she went into treatment and I went nuts. I really didn't know what to do with myself. It was the first time in a long, long time that Scott was by himself. They had managed to give her enough time to get her mother placed, I'm sure because she was sure that if I was left at home with her mother, I would probably kill her. And to be honest, that could have happened. It really could have. So I found myself at home alone, and I was scared to death. I really was. My day was determined by what she was like when she woke up in the morning. If she was hungover and felt crappy, wasn't going to be a very good day. Even though I didn't see her, that sort of set the tone for the day. I remember the first week, and what was coming, treatment was something I was totally caught off guard by. I mean, the fact that I couldn't call her, the fact that if I took something to her, they had to check it like she was a prisoner, just really made me so angry, so angry. And I remember the first weekend that she was in treatment, I had had this weekend planned with a friend to go to a blues festival. And she said, I can't see you till Sunday afternoon. Why don't you just go ahead and go and have a good time? So I went to the blues festival, and I got to tell you, if you're feeling really crappy, if you're a crappy feeling Al-Anon, a blues festival is a hell of a good place to go. I mean, this was in Helena, Arkansas. It's at the King Biscuit. It's one of the most. It's a world famous blues festival, and I was with a group of people, and every once in a while, I would slip away from the crowd, and I would go back to the car. And back in 2005, at least the cell phone I had was one of these big honking things that in order to use it, I had to plug it into the car lighter. And I would do that, and I would call her office, because when she had to go into treatment, she left this incredibly long message about, if you need to talk to so-and-so, this, I won't be here. So, you know, this long recorded message, I just wanted to hear her voice. I couldn't talk to her. I just wanted to hear her voice. And I must have done this about four or five times that weekend. That's how bad off I was. I was really in pretty bad shape. When I got back to Birmingham, I kind of forced my way into a meeting with her counselor. And I got in there and I started, you know, reading in the Riot Act. How dare you do this? How dare, you know, don't you realize you're treating her like a prisoner? And she's sitting there just kind of numb because she hasn't had a drink in about a week or so. And he said, you know, you sound a little irritated. I said, yes, you're absolutely right. I am irritated. I'm mad, actually. He said, well, I think you might want to think about going to an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I had no clue what Al-Anon was. I honestly didn't. I remember that when she first went into treatment, that first night I was just, you know, kind of beside myself. And I did find my way to the AA website. And, you know, they may still have it, they had a list of 13 questions. And if you answer three of them, you might have a problem with alcohol. So I looked at them, and at the time, I honestly couldn't answer but one of them, yes. And the question was, has anyone ever complained about your drinking? And the answer was yes. My mother complained all the time because it made me fat. It had nothing to do with my behavior. It just made me look fat. So I found my way to an Al-Anon meeting. Surprisingly, that night, because I didn't want to do anything that was going to give them a reason to keep my wife any longer than she had to stay in there. And the Al-Anon meeting, as it turns out, was right next in a church right next to where I grew up. And I went to the meeting, and there was a very kind gentleman who I still see occasionally today. And he said, well, we'll get the meeting started, and then we'll go, you and I'll go over here into this room, and we'll talk a little bit about the program. So after the meeting started, we went into this room, and he said, what's going on? And that was the last thing he said the entire hour. I talked the entire time. I went on and on and on and on. I must have been just impossible for him to get a word in. And finally, getting to the end of the hour, I must have taken a breath, and he reached over and put his hand on my arm and said, you know, in Al-Anon, we're all control freaks. And I thought to myself, this old idiot hadn't heard a word I've said. Next day, I was visiting day, so I told my wife, I went to that Al-Anon meeting last night, and this guy told me that everybody in Al-Anon's a control freak. Do you think I'm a control freak? She said, no, I am. I said, well, I certainly didn't think I was, but anyway, by the next Tuesday, she went from inpatient to outpatient, so my job changed from enabling her drinking to enabling her recovery. I started following her around like a little puppy. If it was an open AA meeting, I was right there. If it was a closed meeting, and there was an Al-Anon meeting, I would go to that. And this went on for a couple months. A couple people wisely said at one point that I really needed to focus on my recovery and not on my wife's recovery. The one thing I had noticed in the early part of 2005, which was a very difficult time for us, very strange, was that when she left treatment, she had to have a sponsor, and she got a real black belt AA sponsor. And I sort of, you know, I couldn't participate. I watched, and it seemed, you know, I was impressed with what was going on. Still didn't mean I wasn't sick as I could be. I mean, I did a lot of things in that first spring that I, you know, had to make amends for. They encouraged her to keep a journal when she was in outpatient, and I would read the journal when she would leave to go to outpatient. It was really bad. And I was really struggling with Al-Anon. I mean, I went to the meetings that I went to. Of course, they wanted to talk about the solution. I didn't want to talk about the solution. I wanted to talk about her. And finally, I found my way to a meeting which at the time I called warm and fuzzy. They didn't really stress working the steps as much as it was more like a support group, I guess. And I stayed there for a number of years. But as time went on, I realized that I was going to have to get a sponsor. And there were no men at that meeting that really had what I wanted. Also about this time, I wanted to be sure and mention this because it really has a lot to do with my recovery, I think. It certainly was an important moment. But during the Christmas period of 2004, Jan had finished outpatient right then, and our daughter came home from her first year of college for Christmas vacation. Now, she had been going to school on the other side of the country. Anyway, she came home, and because it was her first Christmas back, and all of her friends were back, we really did not see that much of her. So when she got back to school, she called us one night and said that she apologized that she hadn't really spent much time with us and that she would really like to come home for spring break and just be with us. And I said, okay, I don't know about any of you, but we certainly found recovery to be in a very expensive endeavor. And money was tight at that point. So But I agreed, and I went and found a ticket. She sent me the dates, and I went and purchased a ticket online and sent it to her. And about 2 weeks passed, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, we got a phone call. And my daughter was on the other end. My wife was on one line, I was on the other, and she was hysterical. It took us at least 3 or 4 minutes just to calm her down enough to find out what was going on. I mean, we thought maybe she had been raped or mugged. We had no earthly idea what was going on. Come to find out, she had given me the wrong dates. And she had been on the phone for 4 or 5 hours trying to get that ticket changed and couldn't do it. And so her hysteria had to do with the fact that she knew I was going to be mad as hell at her. Now, I had been going to Al-Anon meetings long enough to hear the term the family disease. And it was, you know, that I have a part to play in all this. It wasn't until I got that message from my daughter, or came to that realization, that yes, I have been playing a part. I had a lot to do with the chaos that was going on in our family. And it hit me like a brick. I stayed up the rest of the night thinking about that. And we managed to work it out. And of course, at that point, I had not come across the tradition that talks about, you know, attraction rather than promotion. And I immediately went out and bought one of our daily readers that called Hope for Today. For those of you who aren't familiar, a lot of the readings in it have to do with growing up in an alcoholic family. And I shipped that sucker right off to her. And I remember asking her if she had had a chance to read it. I sent it off saying, maybe this, you might find some help here. And I remember when I asked her, she said, oh, well, I've been really busy, Dad, and I haven't had a chance to catch up. I said, well, Aaron, it's a daily reader. There's no plot line to it, honey. So anyway, but I did, it was during that time that I realized that I really needed to get a sponsor. And since I couldn't find one that at the meeting I was attending on a regular basis, I went back. We have a men's meeting in Birmingham. I went back to that meeting, started going back to that meeting, and that was where I met my sponsor, and we started working the steps. And it's where I first became involved in service. The men's group at that point, 2005, was only about a year and a half old, and the gentleman who had agreed to be the GR of that group, it was a 3-year term, and he got to about a year and a half, and he said, I've got to step down. I've got other issues I have to deal with. And I was working with my sponsor for not very long, really, but we talked about it, and I said, I think this is something I can do. So I agreed to finish out this guy's term. And one of the first time I ever went to area assembly, Paul and I worked the steps, or at least 4 and 5, he had done it where you sort of did those together. So that's what we did. And I remember finishing my fifth step on a Saturday morning, and we always met at this restaurant in Birmingham on Saturday. And from there, I got in the car and I drove down to Montgomery to area assembly. And at that time, the AAs and the Al-Anons met at the same time. Not the case anymore. I didn't know anybody there except for one guy. Now, I had dinner with Kitty that night, the first time we ever met. And for some reason, well, I'm teasing. Kitty's come to be a very dear and close and wonderful friend. I remember at that point, I was only going to go for the day. Couldn't be gone too long, you know. I wasn't going to stay over. So I was kind of standing around in the Al-Anon room, and I looked up, and on the wall they had the legacies. And I'm reading. I say, okay, I finished step 5. Step 6, became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Okay, so at that point, during that time, you had a choice on Saturday night. You could stay in the Al-Anon room for a sharing meeting, or you could go to the AA meeting, which was a big speaker meeting. So I decided to go to the speaker meeting. And I'm sitting there, huge room. Had to be like 250 people in there. And for some reason that evening, the lady who was chairing the meeting chose to use first names and last names. So she's, asked somebody up to read how it works. And then she says, and now we're going to have Dale Stone come up and read the traditions. Well, my father-in-law, who I hadn't seen in 15 years, who we knew had a terrible drinking problem, got up and with this long gray ponytail and read the traditions. And somewhere, I think even in her introduction, she mentioned that he had held some kind of service position with AA in Alabama. And my mouth dropped open. I mean, we had completely lost touch with this man. He lived in Mobile. We honestly thought he was dead. We really had heard absolutely nothing. So needless to say, I didn't hear a word the speaker said that night. I spent the entire evening watching my father-in-law across across the room. And after it was over, I walked up to him and I said, and we had this kind of cryptic conversation. And he told me that he had been in AA for about 20 years and, you know, da-da-da. And I tell him, well, it was good to see you, and I leave, and I'm driving back to Birmingham, and and my mind starts going crazy. I mean, it's off and running. 20 years in AA, where the hell are our amends? And, you know, I'm about halfway back up to Birmingham, and I go, oh, I guess this is what they're talking about when they say entirely ready, and I'm obviously not. And I will have to say at this point, I am very grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if it weren't for them, for this fellowship and this program, my wife and my father-in-law would not have had a relationship of any kind. Now, they didn't really get back to a father-daughter relationship, but they did manage to have some relationship, and for that I'm very grateful. From GR, I got involved in other aspects of service in our area. I got involved in conventions. We've had three of them in Birmingham, and I've had a little bit to do with all of them. I was a district rep for a while. In 2013, we did a big convention in 2012 that I was chairman of. And, you know, the interesting thing, there, I get asked to do things that I'm fairly good at, or at least I'm good enough to be dangerous, and I think Bo can attest to that. I know enough just to be, so many people step up for positions in service in our organizations, and they, you know, they have to be secretary or treasurer, and they have no earthly, I have never done that before. People ask me to do things like make flyers. Now, I can make a flyer. So I've been really fortunate, and one of the things that I have found so incredibly important in Al-Anon in terms of my recovery is that service has kept the program front and center. And for that, I can't say enough about that. I am grateful. I know many people today and through the years who've actually said, you know, made a comment, you know, like, gosh, I can't wait till Monday so I can go to my Al-Anon meeting. And I'm thinking, we have Al-Anon meetings all over the city. You can go to as many as two, even three in one day if you wanted to. We are incredibly fortunate. Service for me has managed to keep it present in my mind. It's not something I shove away or put away. And that has become very important. I can't say enough of it about, you know, what service has meant to me. It has really helped me tremendously in my recovery, But even with all of the different positions that I've held, the most important service thing I can do is run a beginner's meeting. To this day, that's without a doubt the most important thing there is, because maybe it's making amends for that first one that I went to. I do let people talk. I just don't let them talk the entire hour. I try to share with them a little bit about what this program is and what it has meant to me. And if they will give it just a little bit of a chance, it could seriously make a big difference in their life. So, one other part of my talk that I wanted to make this morning is the fact that, my service has moved from the work directly with the district or the area, although I still take care of the area website and the district website. But I've in the last few years, I started helping New Life Productions with their recordings. And recently, I'd say in the last 2.5 years, it's been pretty much Bo and I to do this. And it has been such an incredible gift. I remember, I think it was one of the first times I ever met Bo, and was in 2006. Our area convention was in Auburn, and up to that point, I don't remember ever hearing an Al-Anon speaker that really, fired me up, to be honest, that I walked away going, wow, that was awesome. Now, I hadn't heard Bo. I'd met him, but I hadn't heard him. But I hadn't heard anybody at that point, and at that convention, there was a lady from Cincinnati who came and spoke, Kathy H., and it was a remarkable talk. I made a point of taking that recording with me, and that started me on a path of listening to speakers. And I have listened to so many, and since I've become involved with New Life, now I have people coming to me looking for things, and the internet's incredible what's out there. You can find so much recovery. And it's wonderful just to know that I've got a little piece of that I can, I've come across people at beginners meetings, and they're really upset with, quite often with what's going on with their child. And I can reach in the back of my car and say, here, listen to this lady and see what you think. See if you can find some similarities. I think it will help. Was at another retreat in 2000. When was that? 13 or around that? Well, in 2013, one of the things that I did was the district in Montgomery started a workshop to raise money for their conventions, and they brought Kathy back from Cincinnati. And this was a time in our marriage where we were, even though we were both very much involved in our programs, things weren't really going very well. 2012 to 2013, for my wife in particular, was difficult. She lost both of her parents during that period. She had a job that was just eating her lunch. And we just, we were not connecting. We never fought through any of our marriage. We've been married for almost 32 years now, and we've never fought. We did communicate a lot of times, but we never fought. And this was a particularly difficult time, and I was, as I said, I was district rep at that time, and one of the things I tried to do in 2013 when I started it, started this position, was to visit every group that we had in our district. And there were 28 of them at the time. And I came pretty close to hitting every one of them. And I got more involved with New Life. And we were down in Montgomery recording this workshop that Kathy was doing. And there's a story that she told that I have, used over and over. The Saturday morning of the workshop, her host took her out to breakfast, and Kathy ordered her breakfast, and when they brought it to her, they put a bowl of grits right there by her plate, which she did not order. And she turned to her hostess and her host, and she said, "Tell me something. Do grits come with every breakfast served in the South?" And Corey said, "Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, pretty much." And she said, "Oh, it's kind of like God's grace. It comes with everything. It's just your choice of whether you take it or not." Well, when she told that story, I just said, "Wow, this is awesome." I love that story, and I've obviously held on to it for a long time. As I said, we were going through some difficult times at that point, and one day my wife came in, and she wanted to talk. The downturn in the economy was very difficult for me. I mean, I eventually wound up moving my business home. I was working for myself. So I had an office there at the house. The same one that I had painted bright yellow for my mother-in-law was now a nice neutral gray, but and full of computers. But my wife came in and she wanted to talk. Now, at the time, I was going to a lot of meetings, and I had really, you know, I'd talked with a lot of people about, you know, what was going on, talked with my sponsor. And I had sort of had it figured out. I mean, we had three immediate family members, myself, my wife, and my daughter. And all three of us, at one time or another in our lives, have been profoundly affected by somebody else's drinking. But I was the only one going to Al-Anon. So I had I knew what was going on. I had it all worked out. Well, anyway, she came in and wanted to talk. And at the time, be truthful here. I mean, if I went to her to discuss something, usually the door to discussion was closed. But, you know, when she came to me and wanted to talk, she was more amenable to a back and forth discussion. So I said, "Sure, come on in." And she sat down, and it really doesn't matter what she said. It was just something that caught me completely off guard, to the point that I could say, "I got no answer. I don't know how to respond to that whatsoever." But as we began to talk, as we sat there, we were at a place where not only were each of us able to say what was on our hearts, but we were able to hear what the other person was saying. And as the conversation continued, at that very moment, I sensed God's presence sitting right there with us. It was palpable. I mean, it was incredible. And after the conversation, I think about two or three days later, I came up here and recorded, you know, a weekend up here. And came, and on Sunday night, after I got back from here, we had another conversation at the dinner table. And the same thing occurred. There were three of us sitting there. It was just amazing. And at the end of that conversation, we came to the decision that we wanted to try and make this work. And we have, you know. But one of the great things that I realized from that experience was not only was God at those two meetings, God had been present for those 9 months where we weren't talking to one another. I mean, there was an elephant in the room, but because of these programs, that elephant had kind of a nice patina on it, you know. It was difficult. We were at a position that, you know, it's funny. One thing I left out was, you know, I had told my wife that I didn't think I could go on like this, that I didn't think I could continue living in a marriage like this. And her immediate response was, "Well, let's sell the house, split the belongings, and go." Well, the truth of the matter was, because of the downturn, we had to file for bankruptcy. And we couldn't have gone anywhere even if we wanted to. So we had to stay exactly where we were. It wasn't comfortable, wasn't welcomed, but that's where we were supposed to be. So I haven't come across very many people, though, that have said that chapter 13 is really a gift from God. But in my case, it was, because I wouldn't have stayed there. We would have been long gone, living our lives a different way, if we hadn't had to stay and go through that. So that whole experience was just incredible to me. I mean, I've come to realize that, you know, God is in my life every day, all the time. The biggest thing that keeps me from God is me, is my ego. It happens so often. You know, if I'm going along and I find myself thinking, if only, yeah, I should, if they would only. I'm trying to take back God's power. There's no question about it. There, you know, one of the wonderful, there's so many wonderful sayings and lines that come from these programs, but one of the ones I love so much is that Al-Anon has given me the ability to understand the difference between God and Scott. And that is that God never tries to be Scott. I did say that, yeah. Now me, on the other hand, oh, it's amazing what I try to do sometimes. One other instance that happened not too long after that, but it really came to mean so much. You know, so in my life, I you know, I'm only speaking for me, obviously, but in my life, one of the, so many times, you know, I'll look back and go, oh, well, you know, that was God at work. It was almost like God as I experienced him, you know, never, you know, but because of some of these events, I've come to realize that and been able to appreciate the fact that God is right there, right then. One of those times was another roundup. This time, a friend of mine and I went all the way to Ohio, outside of Columbus. It was a men's retreat up there. And they had, there were about 70 guys there. And they were having a speaker meeting. And this particular roundup, they give away a lot of scholarships. And they have a lot of people with not very much recovery. You know, sometimes a week, even less. And they got a young man up there to read the Ninth Step Promises. And as he started to read those promises, when he got to the part about God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves, the words got stuck in his mouth. They started to really sink into his heart. The room was quiet, but the love that was channeling out of those 70 guys directed at that one speaker was incredible, impalpable. You know, it was so evident at the moment that God was there. And I hope I get that experience more and more often. I think that the awareness that I have gotten, as it will enable me to see that, or to feel that, or to sense that wonderful connection more and more often when it's happening. Because when it happens is right here, right now. You know, it might be nice if I get spiritual tomorrow, but I have no idea. My only hope for conscious contact is right here, right now, with all of you. This is where God is, as far as I'm concerned. And to have that awareness, to have that, just to know that, is so far removed from where I was 14 years ago. It's just indescribable. Just indescribable. I have one other thing. Well, one thing I wanted to close with. It's kind of an epilogue, shall we say. But it really has to do with what Al-Anon has done for me. A story about my daughter, who was scared to death of me. She followed her own path. She went back to school for 2 years. We had to tell her we couldn't afford to send her out to Oregon anymore. She had to come back and finish at UAB. She did that. She tried to get in nursing school, and she had had too good a time in Oregon, so they wouldn't look at her application. So she followed her first true love out to Colorado. And when his drinking became to be a bit of a problem, when she would call us, we knew exactly what to say. You know, it was like, well, Aaron, you didn't cause him to drink, and you can't control his drinking, and you can't cure his drinking. You have three choices. You can stay right there where you are right now and be probably as miserable as you are right now. You could come home. You could just leave. Or there's an Al-Anon meeting at such and such church. All you have to do is look it up on the internet. Well, she chose to come home, and then we lived through the breakup. But like I said, it was a bad time of in the economy, and she came home, and within 3 days, she had a job in Birmingham. Now, she didn't see the miracle in that. I saw the miracle in that. I was amazed. She struggled, stayed in a couple of different places. About 6 years ago, it was Father's Day, and she wrote me a Father's Day card. Now, I normally don't read anything when I tell my story, but for this, I still have it with me, and I thought I would share it with you. Let's see here. It says, "Daddy, thank you. Thank you for always listening, no matter how trivial the problem. Thank you for never judging me, but constantly encouraging me. Thank you for helping me, whether it's helping with groceries, fixing a flat, or just telling me everything will turn out okay. Thank you for telling me sometimes, fine, most of the time I'm a little melodramatic. Thank you for showing me through your actions and your words that I don't have to worry so much about what other people think and should just take care of me. Thank you for always being there, no matter what. You're the most wonderful and caring man and father a daughter could ever hope for. I love you." Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a thank you note to Al-Anon, because this was the little girl who was scared to death of me, and that is not the case in our relationship anymore today. So I wanted to close with one of my, I usually close with a story about, has to do with one of the readings in one of our daily readers. On page 65, Encouraged to Change, there's a wonderful reading of or sharing of a gentleman or whoever sharing is talking about the fact that they're a little concerned about the fact that once God removes all their defects of character, their soul's going to look like a piece of Swiss cheese. Now, from my point of view, when I got here, my soul looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. And it has been this program and this fellowship that has managed on a daily basis to fill those holes. So for that, I thank you for allowing me to fill one more hole this morning. Thank you. Mm-hmm.